Questions from Estians.
Well, welcome to Take Three. This edition of Questions from Estians, marked as the best ones are by questions I think I have never been asked before.
Okay.
And also marked.
And short and pithy.
Some of them are, and some of them are less so. But anyway, Jane Stead, here's the question. Has being a parent made you better at your job? So, and then here's the slightly more substantial paragraph. As a teacher, I reckon having children made me a better teacher. I'm certainly not saying that you have to have children to be a good teacher. Some of the best teachers I've known have not had children, and some of the worst have had kids. But for me personally, it made a huge difference. Obvious, you may think, but I presume it would have changed me no matter what profession I had chosen. Maybe empathy, maybe keeping me young, maybe the overwhelming sense of responsibility for someone else's future. Who knows? So, what has having children brought to your job?
Well, can I give you two answers to this? Firstly, as I said, I'm just back from Bergen. And at the Bergen Film Festival, one of the films that was in competition in the documentary strand was a film called The Mum in Me, which was a documentary about involuntary childlessness, which is a subject which is very, very complex and, you know, and fraught. And it's a very brilliant documentary about that subject. And so one of the things that was talked about was that people can find themselves in a position in which they don't have children, and people who do have children almost behave in a morally superior way. Or do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I'm not representing this as well as the documentary did, and I would invite anybody get a chance to see The Mum in Me. It's very, very moving. So I'm very loath to, because obviously I have children and there are many people who don't have children. And we had a correspondent who wrote in to say, why is it that in films, it's always the people who have children, the normal family unit.
Fulfillment, yeah.
Exactly. And I'm more aware of this subject than I was before. So the answer that I'll give is just very personal. It's not a generalization beyond anything other than my personal experience. In terms of my job as a film critic, I think I did change as a result of having kids, but I think the most profound thing was that they put me on notice, that as soon as they started reading my opinions or hearing my opinions and realizing that you know, this is what Dad did, they were very, very quick to criticize. To go, you don't know what you're talking about.
Of course,
you
that's know. What children do.
So, yes. So I would say that they made me better in as much as that they were people close to me who were younger than me, obviously, because they're children, and therefore had a completely different perspective on the world because they are essentially children of a different century. And they picked me up on things that I don't think other people would have picked me up on. That's my personal experience. What about you?
I would say that it's something that I hadn't thought of before, Jane. So thank you very much for asking. In as much as I would say, yes, it probably has made up for other people to judge, but yes, probably made me better at my job. In as much as it gives you, I think, a wider understanding of life because you see life through their eyes. So particularly when you're losing touch with things like children's television, music, cinema, books, all those kind of things that you might have left behind, you then suddenly go, oh, that's happening. That's really interesting. But it's a bit like having kids is a bit like having a hobby, you know? So
I'm wondering where this phrase is going.
In as much as it gives you a wider understanding, it brings you into contact with other people.
I see.
If you're a bell ringer, you know, if campanology is your thing, you'll be out of the house, you'll mix with other bell ringers, you'll talk about bell ringing, and you have a wider understanding of life. So I think anything that broadens your understanding of humanity makes you a better person. So in that respect, having kids does make you better.
I would add to that two of my closest friends are both in long-term relationships, marriages, and do not have children. And I think that both of them have a wider and more broad experience of the world than I do.
Yeah.
I think like what you're saying, it can be an element, but
it's a very specific question.
It is a very specific question.
Which you can only answer personally. And I'm just saying from my point of view, I think if the whole point of being on the radio is that you talk to your audience and you have the same experiences as your audience. And so if they're talking on a Friday night about going out to the movies or going out with their sister or having a chat with their son about it, then it means that you can empathize and it gives you an understanding. So it's purely from that point of view.
No, sure. You know? Yeah, I think that is right. I mean, also, I would say, sorry to drag this out, but the other thing probably that I learned from Parenthood, which, believe me, is something I'm still struggling
with. The movie or just in general?
Just in general, but okay. Well done. When you come in at the third and you want to do with the
diarrhea.
Is you're not the most important person in the room.
No, that's very good. Jane, thank you for the question. This is from Scott Conway, Banbridge, Northern Ireland. First time emailer, Vanguard Easter, 25-meter swimming badge, 1982. This question, Schmestchen, goes back a few takes when you asked what new music or artists that you were listening to or had discovered lately. Simon mentioned he'd been listening to Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit, in particular a song called Letting You Go, and can understand why you would end up with dust in your eyes. So, having gone through the rest of the album and Mr. Isbell's music catalogue, can I just say he knows a thing or two about music? Anyway, that's Mr. Isbell. No, that, is that me? No, that's me. Anyway, this is where things
you
got
know a thing or two about music. Things, Grace Hits Radio, Drive Time.
Thank you.
Radio figures up 700,000.
Something like that.
Boom!
Anyway, this is where things got a little weird or coincidental. You decide. I was watching the Justified City Primeval Limited series continuation, whatever, in the last few scenes. Raylan Givens, played by Timothy Oliphant, is wearing a Jason Isbell t-shirt. Then, after viewing Killers of the Flower Moon, see previous conversation, none other than Jason Isbell is listed in the credits. On further investigation on IMDb, he plays the part of Bill Smith. So he's turning up everywhere. So Scott is getting to his question.
Excellent.
Having never heard of this artist until a few weeks back, he's been popping up all over the place. No algorithms involved. Has anything like this ever happened to your good selves or other listeners? To which the answer is, I think...
All the time. All the time.
You'll meet someone who comes from Mississippi and you don't know anything about Mississippi, and then all of a sudden it's in the news, and suddenly Denmark, for me, you know, now I see Denmark in news stories all the time. Was it always there? Yes. Did I notice? No.
Yeah. I mean... It happens. There's a bit of magical thinking involved in this. You almost get to the point that you believe that you are willing things into existence by thinking about them. So, for example, you'll remember a pop record from 25, 30, 40 years ago that you hadn't thought of for ages, and you play it and you absolutely love it and you tell everyone how much you love it. And then that Friday, on BBC Four, as was, there's a documentary about the making of it, or it gets reissued, or the person is doing a tour. And you go, I literally willed that into now. Of course, you didn't, because it's magical thinking, and magical thinking is another word for magical schmagical. But I think the answer has to be that it's just that you were, that it was always there, you just didn't see it. I think that has to be the answer. And yet, it happens so often. And it's really, really freaky. Like Linda, but to the point that this people end up thinking, and I don't know what the science on this is. You know, your phone's listening to you all the time.
Hi, phone.
Hello, phone. Hello.
I don't believe that it is.
Yeah, precisely. But
Jason Isbell is probably listening to our
us
conversation
all the time. Jason right. Isaacs is definitely listening to us all the
we
time.
We should say hello to Jason Isbell.
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
And Jason Isbell.
And Jason Isbell.
Bill says...
And Jeremy Isaacs as well.
In answer to the question... What is the best premise of any film? The answer is Back to the Future. You're welcome, says Bill. So he's giving us the answer before he's asked the question.
Yeah.
But it is a great premise. The only other thing that sprung to mind when I read that was, what was that? I think it was a horror film where the premise was all laws are suspended for a day.
Yes, that's The Purge.
Right. That's a fantastic premise.
It is.
Any other premises that, you know, like one phrase, one sentence that occurred to you that you
think? I'll give you the premise, of the best premise of a film, although the film, I have to say, didn't live up to it, okay?
Yes.
The film is Iron Sky. Here's the premise. In 1945, Nazis went to the moon. This year, they're coming back.
There you go. There's a tagline.
It's just, you go, yep, sign me up.
This is a question from Ed Freshwater, and we mentioned it was
Hello, Ed.
Third anniversary on Friday of Stinky Pants Week. Dear Art and Genitals,
Yeah, because that's Helen Mirren said that Caligula said, you can say what you like about Caligula, but it has an irresistible mix of art and genitals in it.
Hope you're doing wonderfully well. I have been meaning to email a Schmestchen for a few weeks. It's about a brief comment Mark made about his DVD collection at home. Okay. I assume that Mark has seen every film ever made, Epps, and so the DVD, Blu-ray, VHS, cine home collection must be pretty vast. I can't imagine you keep them all in the living room because it would be the size of Mars. Mm-hmm. So if you have a normal-sized DVD shelf in the living room, how do you decide which movies are kept there and which are archived in your East Wing?
I can tell you exactly how we do
it. What would it take for a movie to get bumped to the archive?
Okay, so every now and then, by which I mean every 2 or 3 years, we have The Cull. You know The Purge?
Yes.
You know, The Cull. And The Cull goes like this. The good lady Professor Herindor says, right, we're going through these and 10 of them are staying. And you've, so we've got boxes, boxes, boxes. And she goes, and there's literally, there's no, means it's going away. Yes, but it's going in the attic. Yes, but I need it on the shelf. Or yes, but I need it on the shelf, really. And most of them, it's like literally she holds it up, no. And you're going, no, don't throw that away. Why? I haven't watched it. You've had it for 3 years and you haven't watched it. All right. So, and it's a brutal, brutal culling system.
Swedish death cleaning.
Dostadning. That's the word, isn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah, you do.
No, I don't.
Yeah, we've said it on the program.
Okay.
The word for Swedish death cleaning is dostadning. I will look it up in a moment. But anyway, so that's exactly how it happens. So up in the attic of our house, and here's the terrifying thing about this, one section is the DVDs that have been set up that we haven't thrown away, but they're not going on the shelf because there isn't any space for them. They're upstairs. Then there is a crawl space into a second area, which is the as yet uncharted lands of Mark's VHS collection, which he promised he would take care of, but never did.
But maybe this weekend he will.
I'm scared to go in there now because I don't even know what's happened to those tapes. I mean, you know, some of them have probably mutated and formed societies.
Matt Loveridge, what is the last thing you said out loud to yourself?
You idiot, Kermode.
I think everyone answering that question, it'll be an exclamation. Won't it?
Yeah. And that's it.
You have got to be kidding.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But I caught my finger in a corkscrew last night. And I think...
You caught it in the...
It was one of those leverage ones.
Yeah.
And I caught my finger in the levery bit. And I said...
And this is when you should have been at Amadeus.
I said, bother. So it's an exclamation.
Okay.
And also... this is good. I like this. Ben from Bolton, two questions. What's the most excited for a film you've ever been? And was it worth the excitement? So I will go first for different reasons. So the Star Wars one,
yeah,
as in the one that we went to go and see in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So when Star Wars one, is it Phantom Menace? We ran the greatest radio competition. It was just a fantastic promotion where we took two people or one person?
It was two person. Two people. It was a winner and a partner.
Okay. It was a week-long promo, and then we had like 4 or 5 finalists. They had to be in the studio on Friday.
So much about Star Wars.
And they had to arrive with a passport, and then that afternoon we got on the plane and went to the screen, to the premiere, which was in Los Angeles, and it was stretch limo. The whole thing was so thrilling. Bose, Pawn Palace to do the shows. So... I think, you know, for all sorts of reasons. Obviously, the fact it was a new Star Wars film was going to be exciting because we didn't know about Jar Jar Binks at the time.
No. That horror had yet to unveil itself.
So Star Wars 1 is the answer. Was it worth the excitement? Well, no. But it was. The whole thing was a fantastic experience. Okay, you?
Oh, it's the most excited I've been about ever.
Before it's come out. So you haven't seen it. See, I think the answer might be, because I'd put this in my list, Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And because of Les Enfants Terribles, I would also add the first Harry Potter film was, even watching the trailer, sent a frisson of excitement through the family.
I mean, the thing I can think of is Bug, which is the William Friedkin film based on the play by Tracy Letts. And the reason that I was so excited was this. I was in Cannes and a colleague, Jonathan Romney, came up to me and went, have you seen the new Friedkin film? And I went, no. He went, you're going to love it. in a way which implied
no one else will.
No one else will. And I then didn't see it for like 3 months, and I was absolutely, and I did love it. I thought it was absolutely great.
So it was worth it. Yeah. Ben, second question is, do you believe in luck? To which the answer is, well, my first reaction was absolutely no. If what you mean by that is some kind of mysterious force, you know, I'm wearing my lucky jumper, or 7 is my lucky number.
Yeah.
If you mean the original meaning of luck was good fortune,
yes.
You know, are you fortunate? Are you blessed? Yes. You know, when things fall well for you, if that's luck, then yes. But I think, do you believe in luck? Makes it sound as though it's some kind of exterior force.
Do you believe in life after love, son?
Also, I don't believe in luck apart from when it comes to football, when obviously...
That's right. What's your rule that you can't...
As
soon as you start watching the match, you start losing.
Yes. Well, as soon as I turn on a match, we let a goal in. So that always happens. So I don't.
So
I
you,
don't
the watch. Man who walks under ladders to prove a point,
yes,
doesn't watch his own team because you're worried that by doing so,
yes,
you will.
The reason why Spurs are having such a top season so far, quarter of the season gone, is because I haven't watched them. I'm sure that if I start watching them, it'll all go to hell in a handcart.
If you just supported another team, you could avoid watching them altogether and they could probably be top of the league.
There you go. Well, they are top of the league. That's the ironic thing.
Oh, well, there we go. It shows how much I know. Can I answer the question?
Yes. Do you believe in luck?
I believe that luck is exactly what it is. It's like luck of the draw, luck of the cards, luck of the thing. And I think that there is no controlling force for it. And I think it is, you know... It is chance and happenstance, and I have been particularly blessed by good fortune. By, you know, when this often comes, people say, "How do I get into film? How do I get into the profession?" And the answer is, well, firstly, to give you advice, I'd have to say you have to get you into a time machine and get you back to 1980 when there was a print industry and in which it was possible to walk into the offices of the NME and it was possible to walk into the offices of City Life and it was possible to walk into the offices of Time Out. And if you were persistent enough, you would get work. And that is not the case anymore. So I don't know how you would do it anymore. And the other thing is, I had the incredible good luck that in my first year of my job, I met in London Nigel Floyd and Alan Jones, and they took me under their wing. And if they hadn't done, I would never have had the profession that I did. And then some years later, I had the incredible good luck of Matthew Bannister putting me in a studio with you. And if that hadn't happened, I would not have the career or indeed the life that I have.
So that is, actually, we mentioned this on Take One. It's the 30th anniversary this week of me taking over mid-mornings on Radio 1.
Does that mean it's our 30th anniversary?
Which is when we started doing this shtick, 1993. Yeah.
Because it's 2023 now. Well, there we go.
How about that?
Happy anniversary.
Yeah, 30 years, but then with a few taken out because you went off and...
My wilderness years.
You had your wilderness years. Joanna Hutchinson, do you see a day when all original stories and film concepts will have been completely exhausted? If such a thing came to pass, how would the industry adapt? I mean, there's a lot more here, but to which the answer is no. Because the same argument would be about tunes and melodies, and offer them, some of them are very, they're copied or they remind you of something. Stories, a lot of them are referencing other stories, but
what's the oft quoted canard about there are only 7 stories? Is it 7 or, you know, what, or people
3?
Say? And to which the answer is, well, that's not true. I mean, people say, well, it's all to do with archetypes, isn't it? It's this story or it's that story. And I go, well, last year I saw a film about a shell living with its grandmother who then dies. And I don't know which story that is because I didn't think I'd seen it before. And I don't think stories or anything will run out. I mean, notwithstanding the argument that people say, well, there's only ever so many stories. Well, fine, they're not going to run out.
Luck, by the way, came from, it's a gambling term and probably originally from the Middle Dutch word geluk, which means happiness and good fortune.
Okay, but if it comes from gambling, it's interesting because I did say like the luck of the draw, you know, it's the card game, isn't it? It's the...
Phil Macker, I was wondering whether either of you obsess over trailers, like us film fans do, and also what are your favourite trailers that then turned into stinkers of movies. My two are The Happening and Tomorrowland. Both had me going nuts over the trailers and obsessing over what the films were going to be like, only to be truly disappointed when I finally got to see the full film. The Happening, a blockbuster about the wind. Tomorrowland, simple, a terrible film to promote a funfair ride. Big hugs and respect to you both for keeping us entertained, sometimes comforted over the years.
I try to avoid trailers.
Me too.
Because it...
Particularly now.
Yeah, the spoilery factor is just so enormous. And I mean, of course, it is interesting that in the past, film trailers used to describe the whole film. But they do bother me. In terms of the... You know, how much excitement. The trailer for Cocaine Bear, I must have watched four or five times back to back. And then I was pleasantly surprised when the film wasn't a total disappointment, because I knew from the trailer that the film was never going to be as good as the trailer. But actually, I thought it was not bad. Iron Sky, which we previously mentioned, you know, in 1945, Nazis went to the moon. This year, they're coming back. The trailer was everything and the film was nothing.
Charlotte Cooper. Yes. I watched The Descent in a cave.
Ooh.
Known as The Devil's Arse. The film was a little more clunky.
It can't have been really called The Devil's Arse.
The film was a little more clunky than I'd remembered, but the venue added a real frisson. Thank you, Charlotte. I looked this up. The Devil's Arse.
It's a real thing.
Yes. It's now called the Peak Cavern in Castleton, Derbyshire. But it was originally called The Devil's Arse. But when Queen Victoria visited in the 1880s, they thought, we can't allow the Queen
to go to the Devil's Arse.
Imagine the Queen in The Devil's Arse, because that sounds like a whole new movie altogether. So they renamed it the Peak Cavern. And it's called The Devil's Arse because of the flatulent sounds which come out of the cave.
Oh, really?
So anyway, thank you very much. Not really a question.
The Devil's Arse.
Finally, that should be a band, isn't it, really? Or the name.
It almost certainly is an Icelandic heavy metal band.
Ruth, final question.
Sorry, everything's falling over here.
What is, I haven't seen anything falling over.
I keep running my chair over my bits of...
Think. Look, we got one more question.
All right, I'm just going to plug that back in again. I needed to move everything out of the way when Thelma was here.
You didn't need anything plugged in for this.
No, but my thing just came on and said I'm running out of power and I don't want to run out of power whilst you're doing the last question.
Ruth from Leafy Cheshire here, proud member of the Vanguard and Horror Obsessive.
Okay, hello.
I have two short and snappy questions for you.
Okay.
What is one thing that you are... I think this is a great question.
Okay.
I've never been asked this. What's one thing that you are secretly really good at? Obviously, it won't be a secret any longer.
Okay. Do the next one and we'll come back to that, right?
Is there a domestic chore that you refuse to do and why? To which the only thing I can think of was replacing scatter cushions on the bed. I don't see the point in scatter cushions. Why are they there? Not for me.
Yeah, but I do it. Because I mean, I feel exactly the same way as you do. It's like they sit there and then you have to take them off to get into the bed. And but the good lady Professor Herring Dawes is so particular about the way that stuff is done. And I have discovered that I can impress her by the correct arrangement of the scatter cushions.
Well, maybe this is the answer to the other question. The thing that you're secretly good at
is the correct arrangement of the scatter cushions. The thing that I'm secretly good at that nobody knows about.
It's a really, really good question.
Have you got an answer? Oh, good.
The only thing,
oh, good. Here we go.
The only thing that I could think of,
yeah,
that I was secretly good at, is that I did get praised by a surgeon for my preparation for a colonoscopy. He said it was a particularly good preparation, and I took some comfort from that. Perhaps at the time I was distracted, but that has to be a secret. I've never said that before,
And now
it's out there.
Now it'll be on the Wikipedia page faster than you can say edit history.
So is there something you're secretly good at apart from arranging scatter cushions?
But secret. When you say secret, I mean not secret because you've kept it a secret, but secret because people don't know about it.
Yeah, I guess it's just something that you're actually really good at that no one knows about. Look, I've done my colonoscopy. What have you got?
Yeah, okay. All right. It's...
You don't have to say.
No. I can.
Depends how secret
it is. It's just secret. It's not secret. It's obsessive compulsive.
Right.
Okay. So
you're good at this.
Well, yeah. Thereby hangs a tale. All right. So there is a shape that I constantly draw.
I know this. Yes.
Yeah. I've told you. Okay.
Draw it in the air.
I draw it everywhere, all the time. It's a constant thing, okay? The problem with it is that it's a start point and a finish point that has to end up. So it goes, I've shown it to you, but it goes like this and it goes like that.
Describe it.
The best way of describing it is it looks like a bisected Subutio bottom,
right,
with a number 9 where the player should be.
Okay.
So it's like something that's on it's a roll, and then there's a number 9 sitting in the middle of it, but the when it gets to the outside, it goes in and then up to the number 9 like that. Okay. So what I do is I start here, and I go down, round, then up like that, and then up the number 9, which has to be right in the middle. And then there's a bump, and then you have to come back to exactly the same spot. And if you miss it, you have to do it again.
That you're answering a different question.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I am really good at it.
Yes.
And if you ask somebody else to do it, well, firstly, they'd say no.
But they might be brilliant at it, but...
No, but they don't know. Okay, but my secret skill is, and I can do it, like, anywhere, at any time, and
what does
no,
it represent?
Like, who...
Correspondence at kevinamay.com. What on earth... I mean, I know this has come up on the show before.
Yeah, and I don't know where it came from. The only thing I can imagine that it is, it's like Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and at some point, the aliens will come and...
Shaped like a nine on a Subutio thing,
and they will go, you are the chosen one, and I will go off in a spaceship.
Okay.
Yeah, I did once tell it to the good lady professor her indoors, and she just went, "Oh, for heaven's sake!" I said, "You know that I do this."
When do you draw that?
All the time.
In the air.
On the table, which I'm sort of doing now, with about barely moving, all the time. Like, all the time.
If you're a clinical psychologist, could you let us know what's going on there? Correspondence at Kevin
O'Malley. Good luck with that, but I'm really good at it.
Okay,
well, I'm really good at it.
Wow, impressive skills. You can draw the thing, and I can prepare for a colonoscopy better than anyone else.
And is that the last question?
Yes.
So can I therefore leave us with the greatest film review of all time, Roger Ebert reviewing The Brown Bunny. I know I brought this up before. He reviewed it at Cannes. He said, "I had a colonoscopy once. They let me watch it on a television screen, and it was better than The Brown Bunny."
See you for take one on Friday.